The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us science@newstalk.com. We're on Twitter at @NewstalkScience, and we get to all of them later on in the podcast from last week. Coming up on this week's show, why personalized vaccines could be the holy grail for future pandemics. First, though, we're going to look back at some of the stories from last week's science news, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Susan Kelleher, also of that parish. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat, mission abort.
Explorer, this is Kowalski confirming visual contact with debris. Debris is from a BSE sat. To repeat, I have...
Dr. Stone requesting fast transport.
We have to go.
Shane, has to do with the International Space Station, and this sort of sounds like a computer game.
Absolutely. A Dodgems computer game, which shows listeners how much I know about computer games.
I was just going to say, Dodgems is not that's a fairground game, but like this is about an international space station having to dodge debris. It's kind of like asteroids or something.
Yeah, so the International Space Station is in a low Earth orbit. So it's about 420 kilometers above us on the surface, moving incredibly fast. But it's not the only thing that's in that low Earth orbit. Since the beginning of the space age, we have managed, as we have everywhere else in the human biosphere, to fill it with a lot of crap, with rubbish. So there's a lot of space junk.
Milk cartons, shopping trolleys, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, a student's flat in
traffic
in
cones.
Like May.
Yeah, exactly.
So they the space station, though, is well used to getting out of the way of the space junk. It can cause incredible damage. So people think that the space station is in a zero gravity environment. It's not. It experiences about 90% of the gravity that we do.
What?
But the reason, that it doesn't fall back to Earth is it has an incredible sideways or orbital speed. So when you launch something into space, most of the energy is actually required to build up that sideways or orbital speed. A fraction of it is required to escape the surface. So you have to build up this incredible speed. It's moving at around 27,500 kilometers an hour, which is far, far faster than a bullet. So if it's moving that fast and it hits something like a piece of space junk, even if it's very small, it can cause a huge amount of damage. It would be like having your car being sprayed by bullets, right? Which wouldn't be good, I imagine. So the astronauts, they have to maneuver the space station. They have thrusters on it to dodge the space junk. And just last Tuesday, they carried out what's called an avoidance maneuver to dodge some pieces of space junk that came within several kilometers of the space station, which in space terms is a very, very near miss.
Is it a near miss? Several kilometers. I read that, well, because I read it, because they had to, didn't some of the astronauts have to like move to a specific part of the International Space Station? That led me to believe we're talking inches. Kilometers away is not that much of a, I don't know.
Well, firstly, nobody uses the term inches on the International Space Station, Jonathan. Thank you. They got into the Soyuz capsule, which is in case they'd need to escape. So that's the Russian, it's not a
wing.
Rocket, but it's the, yeah, it's exactly, it's the Russian escape unit. And they were in there ready to kind of blow the hatch and escape for home if they needed to, but fortunately they didn't.
Is that a regular recurrence, or does that only happen rarely? Like, this was obviously, all joking aside, it was obviously much closer than you might imagine.
It is a fairly regular occurrence, and reading about it in the newspapers this week, and on NASA's website, you can see that they're having to do this more often than they used to. So it's, you know, we have to think carefully about all the stuff we put up. There is a huge amount of
I haven't put anything
satellites.
Up there, Shane. I can guarantee you I've not put anything in space. So it is other people. This is one. This
how
is
does
the
your
one
GPS
time.
Work?
Well, did I put that satellite there? It's the one time, you know,
well,
when I talk about like the great achievements of humankind on the program, I always say we. This is not a we. This is a they This is a vague situation. our second story, Susan, has to do with butterflies.
Yeah, I'm sure that many listeners are familiar with the sight of a butterfly basking in the sun. So apart from just being a really nice way to spend a morning, butterflies need to do this as they can't actually fly unless their body temperature is greater than 30 degrees Celsius.
Oh.
Yeah, they are cold-blooded. So they sit in the sun and their wings are spread out and they act like solar panels, essentially, to heat them up and get them going. But equally, if they get too hot, this also causes problems. Because they are cold-blooded, they can't regulate their body temperature. Researchers in Cambridge were really interested in understanding more about this. And so they painstakingly captured 4,000 butterflies in their local area and investigated their ability to regulate body temperature. And they found that many butterflies evolved to do different things to help regulate their temperature. So they angled their wings at different sort of away from the sun, or their wings have a different color that doesn't absorb as much heat, for example. Right. But some unfortunate butterflies, which haven't evolved as well, rely heavily on their environment to provide shade and shelter. So these butterflies basically have to take a breather to cool down in sort of long grass or in hedgerows in order to then be able to get up and keep going. So the concern is really that, sadly, like countless species that we know, you know, whose habitat is being lost, these shade-loving butterflies might very well be in trouble if we don't, I suppose, ensure that we provide those types of habitat for them to sit down, cool down, and then get going again on their day.
I'm sorry, wait, like what? If we don't provide shade for butterflies, is there not? We're not talking
putting up your sun, you know, your parasol out the back. We're saying like long grass, make sure you don't maybe cut back your hedgerows, you know, in the same way that the bees need, you know, the flowers and specific types of, you know, pollinators need those flowers in your garden. The butterflies also need sort of those sheltered spots. And I suppose as urbanization is taking over and as we're managing farmland in a very different way, we are reducing the natural habitat for those types of species. Nice. And you know, I never really considered the plight of the butterfly, but there is, you know, there are butterflies out there who need our help.
Yeah, not really sold on that one.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I know a whole, I know trained doctors have looked at that, but like, I'm just struggling to find a situation where a butterfly can't find shade and then.
Let's just leave your grass grow. Everyone will win. You know,
okay.
Bees and butterflies.
Don't worry, I'm great at that. My wife hates it, but I'm great at letting the grass grow. Our third story, Shane, has to do with this really clever device that Chinese researchers have developed that could end up creating sort of self-charging clothes.
Yeah, it's a perfect example of the triboelectric nanogenerator effect that's exploiting the Bernoulli principle, Jonathan, you know. That's the title of the paper. When I read it first, it was like, oh my God, there's so many things there that I learned a long time ago in college that I don't remember what they mean. So basically the way I would describe this is, you know, when you rub a balloon against your head, you get that buildup of static charge. So that's exploiting something called tribology, which is the interaction of surfaces.
Friction.
Friction is the, I suppose, the force that's required to make it move. But the interaction itself is called tribology. And you can build up a static charge. And what these researchers across China have done is they've managed to make that on a nanoscale or using nanomaterials. And they're exploiting the movement from the wind, basically, to make and store charge. So let me explain what that actually looks like. They have this cylinder, and in the cylinder, they have two flappy bits of material that looks like two little sheets of paper. Those bits of paper are made out of nanomaterials, and they exploit the Bernoulli principle, which is the principle that explains how planes fly and flags flutter. So when wind passes across them, they move, there's a force.
Right.
And that causes the friction or the tribology, which generates charge, and that can be used potentially to do things like, you know, charge your mobile phone or light up lights.
Yeah, you can have a look at the video. It's on our Twitter page. We're at News Talk Science. Cute little invention and potentially lots of use in both personal technology, but also, gathering electricity from remote places and so on. Our final story, Susan, has to do with a rather unusual experiment.
Yes. One of my favorite things about being a research scientist is that if I have a research idea I'd like to investigate, I have a wonderful team and an amazing lab where I can go in and try things out. One thing I have not ever thought about of investigating is if I could make a knife out of poo. Now, why would I? But Martin Aaron, a researcher from Kent State University in Ohio, did wake up one morning and decide to explore this. So he had been inspired by a legend he had heard throughout high school life of an Inuit man who had made a frozen knife from his own feces and killed a dog. So Mr. Aaron also happens to be an anthropologist professor. And so he did have a real interest in how such legends and stories are passed down through time. So in order to prove the story's credibility, he collected his own feces over a week and molded them into the shape of the knives that Inuits used at the time that this story was believed to have happened. He then froze them and tried to cut the hides of different animals with them, which I look, there are great photos that you can have a look at. Your imagination can run wild with this one. It's exactly as you imagine. It gets messy. To quote the researcher, the knives failed miserably. So not really a great success, but he did, however, win what's called the Ig Nobel Prize, which is a sort of a Darwin award for science that, while not groundbreaking, you know, it's awarded to people who essentially first make people laugh and then make them think.
That should be the motto for this show.
Make them laugh, then make them think. Why not, Shane? First, we have to make them laugh, though. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD, thank you very much. Now, one word that will be at the forefront of many people's minds right now is the word vaccine. When a vaccine for COVID might seem a long way away, it's important to stay on top of vaccinations for seasonal flus and indeed those for your children. But what if instead of getting a seasonal jab every year, we just had to get it once in our lifetime? And what if we had personalized vaccines that suited specific groups of the population? There are lots of researchers working on this problem, and one of them is Dr. Ofer Levy. He is a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and director of the Precision Vaccines Program at Boston's Children's Hospital. And welcome to the program, Ofer. Nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you as well. Thank you.
So give us a quick rundown on how vaccines work again. It's a little bit of something to provoke a response in your immune system, right?
Right. And the term, of course, vaccines come from the Latin root vacca or cow. How the cowpox was used to protect against a related virus, the smallpox, right? But what vaccines really do is they introduce foreign material into the human body, and the human body is smart. It has a defense system that we call the immune system. And the immune system is comprised of cells, white blood cells, for example, we call them leukocytes scientifically, and fluid factors floating in our blood like antibodies. And what happens when a foreign material enters our body, it gets gobbled up by certain types of white blood cells that talk to other white blood cells and initiate an immune reaction. Rapidly within hours to days, but then over weeks, what happens is specific immunity. And that's the situation where the body will produce, for example, antibodies that could specifically bind that foreign material and help rid the body of it and protect against future infection. In addition to these antibodies that your listeners have probably heard of, there are also certain types of white blood cells or leukocytes, such as T cells, that are able to identify, for example, virus-infected human cells and rid the body of them. So the immune system has multiple arms and is smart and remembers what it's seen in the past. And that really is the basis of vaccination, because then the next time that individual may encounter a related microbe or infection, that immune system will kick in and recognize it much faster and clear it before it causes disease.
Yeah, it's kind of like I used to play a lot of Street Fighter 2 when I was younger, and there were specific moves that each character would do in a battle. And if you learned how to defend yourself against them, you know, you'd always be able to defend yourself against them afterwards. But some of them were particularly like, E. Honda's rapid punch was very difficult if you were stuck in that. Anyway, I'm digressing slightly. Let's talk about the different types of vaccines, because there's live vaccines and well, dead vaccines. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. The live ones are weakened versions of a germ or a related germ that's not very active in humans, but cross protects, right? Like the cow pox can protect humans against the smallpox, right? Or for example, some of your listeners might know a live vaccine called Bacille Calmette-Guérin or BCG that protects against tuberculosis. It is Mycobacterium bovis. It's a live cow tuberculosis, if you will, that protects humans against the human tuberculosis. So those are live vaccines, and those are the most ancient types of vaccines. But then in more modern medicine, folks have developed, you call them dead vaccines, yes, killed vaccines, but also vaccines that are just composed of a little part of the microbe, like just a protein or something like that.
Yeah, and I think this approach is so clever. So what they're doing is they're just showing you the shape of the attacker so that you know what to do in the future, because actually presenting the real thing is much more dangerous and much more problematic.
There was an attitude 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, that all this stuff with live vaccines is old school. That's how we used to do it. You know, 100 years ago, weaken the germ in test tubes outside the body and then use a live. And that we're all moving to a modern era where everything will be just pure DNA, RNA, or protein vaccines. Maybe. But we are finding out that the live vaccines activate the immune system in a fundamentally different way than the killed or subunit ones, and may have value in broadly protecting against a range of different pathogens. So it's a more nuanced story, and maybe we talk about that some more, but I just want to put that out there. Yeah.
Yeah. So the response level obviously is really important. And I suppose that's what you're looking to really work on with personalized vaccines. Tell me what a personalized vaccine is.
Right. Well, your listeners may have heard of the concept of precision medicine. You know, if you have 10 people in the room and you give them all a pill to swallow, some drug, you know, that's supposed to, some sort of medication, the 10 individuals will likely vary somewhat or maybe even a lot in their reaction to that drug. You know, how high the level goes, how their body responds to it, whether they have a side effect or not, right? Humans aren't uniform, right? We vary in a lot of factors in our genetics, you know, the DNA we're born with, in our epigenetics, you know, what we eat, how much exercise we get, where in the world we live, what air we breathe, all of this can impact our immune system. And so although vaccines were traditionally developed as one size fits all, that you'd have one vaccine. And of course, from a public health standpoint, that would be the easiest, right, Jonathan? You have one vaccine, it's gonna work well in everybody and you're done.
Yeah.
Reality is much more complicated than that. And a lot of biomedical research has indicated that in certain populations, in fact, those that get the most infections, like the very young and the elderly, their immune system's different. And often they don't respond the same way to a vaccine as a healthy middle-aged individual would. And so all sorts of demographic features, age, sex, where in the world we live, et cetera, even what time of year you give the vaccine, can have an impact on the response, the immune response to a vaccine, and sometimes to how protective the vaccine is. And so vaccines are not one size fits all. And so that brings a precision medicine concept to vaccine development, which is an innovative idea.
I'm just tired thinking about the amount of work that is, all the different configurations you have to run to try and make it work. But of course, one of the ways you can short circuit having to run lots of phase one, phase two, phase three trials across gender, environment, country, race, and so on, is by working with these vaccines in vitro.
Exactly, outside the body. So one of the things our program does, our precision vaccines program based at Boston Children's Hospital, has about 40 scientists, data experts, and administrators that we work on site. And one of the techniques we use is to model the human immune system outside the body. You have volunteers that donate blood. That blood contains white blood cells that are important to vaccine responses. And we can study those white blood cells outside the body in test tubes and in culture dishes. And we can add to the different wells of a plastic culture dish that have our blood or our cells in different formats, we can add different vaccines or vaccine components and compare How does a baby response look? How does a middle-aged individual, male or female, how does an elderly individual respond? How does somebody with an immunocompromising condition respond, et cetera? And that ability to model outside the body is key, because if you think about it, I think you were alluding to this, Jonathan, if you take all the pathogens, the microbes we want to protect against, coronavirus, HIV, respiratory syncytial virus, the list goes on and on. For each of those, there are many candidate antigens. The antigens are the part of the vaccine that your body remembers and makes antibodies against, right? So for each of these diseases, there are many candidate vaccines, many candidate antigens to use. And often in vaccines, not always, but often, we find the need to add another component to the vaccine called an adjuvant. That's from the Latin adjuvar, which means to help or aid. That's a molecule you might add to the vaccine that boosts the immune response. It's not the part your body remembers, but it leads to a higher response, higher antibody levels that last longer. You see, a lot of vaccines require multiple doses to be effective. We're racing for a coronavirus vaccine here in the United States and around the world. We have 300 million people just in our country alone. Imagine trying to immunize all of them. Now imagine trying to immunize all of them twice if you need a two-dose series. So this is not trivial. Adjuvant may be able to have dose-sparing effects where you get a stronger immune response so you don't need a second dose. Maybe you can even build single-shot protection with the right kind of adjuvant.
Is there going to be a trade-off there in terms of the initial response, Ofer? Like, I know that some kids have a bad reaction to some vaccines they get, the bigger ones. If we add adjuvants to these to make the response stronger, are we likely to see more negative side effects as a result?
We hope not. And there are many examples of safe and effective vaccines that do have adjuvants. You know, in I know in Europe, you've had a Cervarix vaccine. You may have heard of it, against human papillomavirus.
Yep.
Right. That it's a cause of cervical cancer. That vaccine has an adjuvant in it that has been safe and effective and has protected many young women from cervical cancer, which is a terrible thing. There's a new hepatitis B vaccine for the elderly called Heplisav. And that one has another type of adjuvant in it. And that adjuvant has allowed that vaccine with two doses to be better than three doses of the conventional vaccine in the elderly. So often in special populations with weaker immune systems, you may need an adjuvant. You only add an adjuvant if you need to, because you never want to make things more complicated than they need to be. But there's plenty of precedent examples of safe and effective vaccines in this world that do include adjuvants, and plenty of experience that responses in the elderly, for example, in coronavirus, the elderly are particularly susceptible to severe coronavirus, as you know, and their immune system is relatively weaker, and therefore the need for an adjuvant is likely. And so responses to adjuvants also vary by age. That's why we are personalizing it. We're testing outside the body for each group which adjuvant may be best.
I'm thinking of all of the work that has been done on vaccines that got thrown in the bin because of that efficacy problem at phase three clinical trials. So a company makes a vaccine. It looks great in vitro. It looks great phase one. Looks fine to go to phase two. And phase three, $1 billion later, it turns out it's not going to do the job it's expected. I'm wondering, knowing now what we know about how personal a response is to a particular vaccine, could we have thrown the baby out with the bathwater with a lot of these medicines because we didn't get the result we want, because we weren't cognizant of this difference in response from age, gender, country, and so on? Is that possible?
It is possible. And in fact, it's a conundrum, right? Again, it would be easiest, and hopefully it's true, that we get a generalized coronavirus vaccine that works perfectly in every age group and every part of the world. Maybe, but there's a lot of evidence from prior studies with other types of vaccines that probably is not going to be the case. So it does seem more and more in medicine that as we design these clinical trials, we want to include the right kind of populations in the study. And I would argue it's very important to keep an eye on the most affected. That's why in our coronavirus vaccine research, in our program, we start with the human element. In other words, we are only advancing candidates that look good outside the body against elderly white blood cells, because we reason that if the vaccine isn't going to be very good at activating human elderly white blood cells, it's probably not going to be a very effective vaccine inside the body. So, and we have some examples where the tests outside the body predicted the effect of the vaccine inside the body. So that is an effort. Developing these systems that predict vaccine responses has been funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and by the National Institutes of Health. Most of our funding is from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, led by Tony Fauci. And we're very grateful for that support. And we are partnering with academia, with government, with industry around the world to test various candidate vaccines, antigens, adjuvants outside the body to see which would look best, particularly in the elderly, but then also how about children? You know, children can get inflammatory response syndromes you've heard of with coronavirus. Will there be a vaccine for children? You know, that hasn't been much on the radar either. So we are starting with the populations we believe are particularly important to protect and trying to tailor a vaccine that would look very good to that population.
Is that an approach we took 30, 40 years ago in pharmaceuticals?
No. This is what we are doing is very unusual. It's, we believe, positively disruptive in the space. Usually, vaccine development disregarded all these features. You started outside the body, but not modeling human cells. You just developed something biochemically and then tested it in mice, rodents, rats, maybe pigs and monkeys. And eventually, you went into phase one in healthy middle-aged male and adult. And then you would then eventually, years later, say, hey, will this work in the elderly? Will this work in the very young? Oh, it didn't. You know, that's 20 years later. You find out 20 years later that it doesn't protect certain populations. So we don't have that kind of time right now. Yeah. We're looking to accelerate and de-risk vaccine development.
Do you know, there's probably lots of books on it, but the waste of effort and time and ideas that has occurred over the past number of decades in the pharmaceutical industry, not always for, I mean, often just because someone didn't think of something, is really sad to me, that the fact that all of these secrets of what worked and what didn't work are locked away in private companies. It's one of the true shames of our society that we don't share this data to help people try new things. Are we seeing a revival in people going back to older studies with this new lens of, okay, did it work for a specific population? Is it possible to do that quicker because you can look backwards?
Yes. Thank you, Jonathan. Very good question. So we try to get our hands on vaccines that failed or at some point developed a problem in their usage and test them in our systems. There used to be a pertussis vaccine. Pertussis is whooping cough. There used to be a pertussis vaccine in the world called host cell pertussis vaccine. It was very protective, but it gave too much of a side effect. It gave high fever. A little bit of fever might be okay. Gave high fever in infants. Guess what? If you're an infant, get a high fever, you get a seizure. Febrile seizures, that's rather frightening.
Yeah.
Families running to the emergency room, even though eventually the kids are usually fine. That's not trivial. That's a very frightening experience for that child and that family. That obviously wasn't an acceptable side effect profile. And eventually that vaccine was removed from the US market. But we still study it to try to learn lessons from it outside the body. What about that caused that problem? And can we design something that won't cause that problem? So your comment is spot on.
So I wanted to finish on a question, but there's a few strands to it. So I want you to give me your overall opinion. But we have this rush for a vaccine where there's concerns about safety because we're trying to rush it. There's a community that is already politicized and polarized against many things, vaccines being one of them. And as well as that, there's everyone on the planet that's going to need this vaccine because the virus is that widespread and that dangerous. How much do you think the public is misled in thinking that this vaccine will solve our problems when it comes to COVID-19?
First of all, I have to start with an observation. My observation is that if a year or two ago I was at a movie theater and I saw a movie about a global pandemic that was raging out of control during climate change disasters, racial unrest, and a presidential election, I would say this movie is over the top. Reality never like that. Yeah. Well, guess what? We are living through it right now all over the world and in these United States. And I have trained in infectious diseases my entire adult life, and nothing prepares you for actually living through a thing like this. So let's just take a pause and reflect that as a human species, we've all been through a very difficult year. I happen to be of the Jewish faith, so our new year starts on Friday, Rosh Hashanah. It's a time for reflection, and we make a blessing over apple and honey. Wish everybody a sweet, happy, and healthy new year, and I know the world needs it. I think your question is spot on, and there, as I said, vaccines, it's hard to overstate the beneficial impact of vaccines on human health. Other than clean drinking water, vaccines are the most important human health invention, have saved millions, if not billions, of lives around the world. Smallpox, polio, all of these horrible infections are just echoes of the past right now because of the success of vaccines. And there are many other examples. They are, of course, victims of their own success, because as soon as the disease disappears, you'd be amazed, Jonathan. We are living and breathing this 24 hours a day. Once this pandemic ends, and at some point it will, you'd be amazed how quickly people will want to put it in the rearview mirror. And within a year or two, we will have to start arguing again. Why are they cutting public health budgets? Because as soon as the sun, yeah. as sure as the sun is rising, there'll be another pandemic, right? So, but I will tell you this, most vaccines took 10 to 20 years to develop. We don't have that kind of time. The world wants a vaccine yesterday. Yet, there is, of course, a natural tension between speed, quality, and safety. And how do we triangulate that in the right way? The United States is investing unprecedented amounts of funds into a warp speed initiative to advance 5 or 6 promising vaccines. As you know, these are in phase 1, 2, 3. Some of them are already phase 3 clinical trials. And I believe in the coming weeks and months, there will be data coming out. And I have not seen that data, but I hope it looks as good as possible. And I hope we have something that will be a piece of the equation that will not obviate the need for the public health measures. We will still need to wash our hands, maintain social distance, and the masks. We have to get the mask rates up 95, 100%. Huge, absolutely huge to wear the masks. And a vaccine can be key. Now, how effective is the vaccine? Is it only 50, 60% effective? That's still better than zero. It'll be a great milestone, but we won't be out of the woods yet, and research will continue to make an even better vaccine. Many of the vaccines being studied now require 2 doses. Can you eventually have an adjuvant have one that requires only 1 dose? So even after we get our first vaccine, I think it is likely that there'll be an additional substantial and robust research effort to make next generation even better vaccines against this deadly pathogen.
Well, it's been brilliant speaking with you, Professor Ofer Levy. Shalom. Is it Shana Tova? Is that correct?
Right. Oh, very nice.
Happy New Year, New Jewish Year. And thank you very much. Let's hope your 2021 is a little bit better. Let us know, as you're seeing it before the rest of us, if it's in any way better than what we're going through. Thanks very much for joining us. Last week's program, we were speaking about dyslexia, and I'm always very careful to do this, but I clearly didn't do this once, and someone was listening and got in touch. They said, love your show, but you should not refer to people with dyslexia as dyslexic people. They are just people with dyslexia. I know that it was a slip of the tongue. Sometimes when you're just broadcasting, you don't always remember to correct yourself. Apologies, of course. There was no offense there. It was just a slip of the tongue. Sorry about that. We were also talking about brain experiments and putting implants into people's brains. And someone says, where do they find willing participants for the brain experiments? Well, if you're a regular program listener, you probably know the answer to that, which is it's poor old epilepsy patients. So if you have hardcore epilepsy, and it's not a scientific term, you sometimes need to have brain surgery, and they actually do open up your skull to perform surgery, and sometimes those I imagine in the epilepsy, if there is an epilepsy specialist wing or ward or hospital, the researchers are hiding behind the curtain, just waiting for fresh participants, because there's such rich science that can be done when you can access the brain directly, that they are a really solid target for researchers doing this. I imagine that's the case with this particular study we were talking about last week. I'm not entirely sure. We were talking about the life on Venus and how it's too acidic for living things. And someone anonymously, I might point, texted in saying, isn't there plenty of acidic life on Earth? The mother-in-law, for instance. Or father-in-law, anonymous texter. And then we were talking about black fish, these amazing ultra black fish that live in the ocean and they absorb 99% of all visible light. Luke Benson says, was fascinated by how these fish have evolved to absorb and deflect light in order to survive. Great segment. Yeah, I love those things where we find a weird ass creature and then and hear all about it. And then Ali Fox says, sea life blows my mind. Marine organisms, of course, not the tenebrae. May I say, number one, there's also one in Galway. And while they may be the McDonald's of nature experiences, I and my children absolutely love it. And I have spent many hours in both sea life aquaria. And we've had an absolutely fantastic time. We've learned lots. We've seen new things. And to me, it's kind of like going to an art gallery where the pictures move. These things are so beautiful. And unless you're lucky enough to dive, and obviously not off the coast of Ireland, unless you're lucky enough to dive, you don't get to see these living creatures anywhere else. And I think they're brilliant. So that's my thoughts on it, Ali Fox. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing, Simon Keane, Steve Daunt, and Garrett Mulhall, who were researching, and Steve McClune, who's on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, where we'll be talking about the kindness of strangers. Until then, stay curious.